Bob Newhart is perhaps the only man in the world who can talk to himself on the phone without people looking at him strangely. He of the world-famous one-way phone conversations is also a household name to generations, thanks to not one, but two extremely successful long-running programs, The Bob Newhart Show and Newhart. But it is stand-up comedy that made Newhart famous. His 1960 album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, was the first comedy album ever to go number one on the charts. His albums are filled with classics. The Driving Instructor, Bus Driver School, or Abe Lincoln talking with his PR man.
Listen, Abe, I got to know it. What's the problem? You're thinking of shaving it off. Abe, don't you see that's part of the image? Right, with the shawl and the stovepipe at the string tie. You don't have the shawl. Where's the shawl, Abe? You left it in Washington. What are you wearing, Abe? A sort of cardigan?
I'm Joe Donahue. You're hearing my 2006 interview with comedian Bob Newhart, who passed away Thursday at the age of 94. We play that conversation this morning in memoriam.
Newhart talks about how, after all these years, it's still a kick for him to go out and do stand-up.
It still is, yeah. I started there. That's where I started my career. There's a certain freedom in being out there that you don't really get in other forms, you know, and especially movies, you know, when you have to do something 10 or 12 times over and over again, you know, and from different angles. And at one point when you're doing a television show, even in front of a live audience, you have to kind of lock everything in on Thursday because the cameras are making their moves on particular lines. So there's a freedom you have in doing stand-up, and there's an immediate gratification, you know, from the audience.
No matter how many times you do it, no matter how many times you go out on stage, is it ever comfortable?
For some people it is. I get a... it's hard to describe. I wouldn't call it... It's an adrenaline rush, kind of, you know? It isn't fear. It's because you're never sure. You know, every audience is different, and because it worked last night doesn't mean it's going to work tonight, and... That's kind of the Russian roulette quality of it, and maybe that's the lure of it, the unexpectedness of what awaits you, you know.
And as you say, you never know. What was your worst experience on stage with an audience?
Oh well, when I first started out, I played a club in Windsor, Canada, called the Elmwood Casino, and my record was not. Nobody knew who I was. I was just a stand-up comic on a bill with some jugglers and singer and a line of girls, and I did two shows a night. I was there for a week and never got a snicker in 7 days. It was, I mean, they weren't rude or anything. They just, well, they barely looked up. They, you know, they just kind of sat there, you know. And apropos of that, my wife and I were in Palm Springs, and Harpo Marx and his wife introduced themselves and invited us to their house, and we went to their house. He was showing me these photographs he had of their career, you know, which was fascinating. And he had this one playbill of somewhere in Iowa, and I said, of all the playbills, why would you keep this one? You know, because of all the playbills you and your brothers had over the years. Mm-hmm. Why would you keep this one? He said, because nobody got a laugh for a whole week. So, I don't know, there's some kind of... it's funny, when comedians talk, they usually talk about the bad shows. You know, when singers and dancers... They talk about how successful they were and how great everything went and how great the band was. But there's something about comedians that if you talk about it, maybe it won't happen, you know, because it's an experience we've all had. There's no other way of, and it happens even today. It may happen less and less, but it even today you can go out there and just nothing. It's kind of a wake up call.
Now, professionally, you began as an accountant.
Yeah.
In Chicago.
in Chicago.
And how did you make the transition?
Well, I didn't like accounting. I shouldn't say I didn't like it. I wasn't very good at it. I found it kind of stultifying, and there isn't a lot of humor in accounting, although these days I guess someone could argue that there is with Enron, I guess, the way they cook the books. They came up with funny books, let's put it that way.
I worked as an accountant for a number of years in Chicago, and I had a kind of a strange theory of accountancy. I had always felt, if you got within $2 or $3 of it, but this never really caught on.
So I just decided, people along the way told me, gee, you're funny, you think funny, that's a funny idea. And I just decided, I was married, and I had no obligation toward anyone, and I just decided I'm going to try it and see what happens. And another guy and I, we had a radio show, which was kind of like Bob and Ray, kind of a poor man Bob and Ray.
How do you do, sir?
Oh, how do you do?
How do you do? May we have your name, sir?
Yes, my name is Dr. Arnold Carruthers.
Arnold Carruthers. Dr. Arnold Carruthers.
That's right.
I see. Are you a medical doctor?
Yes, I'm a physician and surgeon.
And surgeon, I see. It's awfully early in the morning for you to be out, doctor. Where are you headed?
Well, normally I would be going to the office about this time. It so happened last night I got a call about 10:30 from one of my patients. Had an emergency appendectomy, and I had to get down to the hospital. I got down there about 11 o'clock, and we had the patient on the operating table around 11:30, and then I opened the patient.
Got right to work, is that right, doctor?
Naturally, yeah. And around 12 o'clock, opened the patient up, and we ran into complications, and it was a very difficult operation, and the patient, as you can see, was on the table for pretty close to...
quite a long while, right?
Well, as I say, we opened the patient up at 12, and I closed the patient up at... I'm sure I closed the patient.
That didn't work out. And then I was going to give it a couple of years, and then like 2 years wound up being 4 or 5. But there was always something on the horizon that held out some promise of, although I will say along the line, I sat up bolt upright in bed and said, what have you done, with your life? all your friends are getting married and buying cars and buying homes, and you're working at a department store, taking part-time jobs. So there was that period about, I'd say maybe 6 months or a year before I cut the album, what the hell have you done with your life,
And then the release of The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, it was a smash hit.
Right now, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Newhart.
It was a huge album.
Beyond our wildest expectations. I just had no... I mean, I was doing a Man on the Street show and very happy to be doing a Man on the Street show in Chicago on a television station a year before. And now I'm getting calls from the Ed Sullivan show saying, how about 6 appearances? It was just surreal what went on.
Were you at all ready for the success?
Probably not. No, I don't think anybody is ready for that kind of success. I had to kind of, there was an awful lot of, I would say, bravado for about 3 or 4 years of acting like I knew what I was doing when in fact I didn't really know what the hell I was doing. But that allowed me the time to learn my craft, and the only way to learn it is working in front of audiences, there's no shortcut.
Man, I think you'll agree. I've been pretty lax as far as discipline is concerned, and golly, nobody enjoys a joke more than I do. But I would like the executive officer returned. Now we've looked in the torpedo tubes. We've looked in your bags, I mean, it's been over 2 weeks, man. We're just damn lucky that it wasn't the navigational officer or someone real important like that. Looking back on the mutiny, I think a lot of the trouble stemmed from the fact that you men weren't coming to me with your problems. As I told you, the door to my office is always open. I think you know why it's always open. That was stolen. I'd like that.
Hello?
Bob Newhart is probably best known for his television work, the star of both The Bob Newhart Show and Newhart. But it's interesting to note that Newhart has more Grammys than Emmys. In 1960, Bob's first album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, became the first comedy album ever to go number one on the charts. Seven more albums followed, each extremely successful, selling in the millions. In fact, his longevity record for holding the number one and number two chart positions simultaneously was not broken until 1995 by Guns N' Roses.
We remember comedian Bob Newhart this morning, a man who starred in such films as Elf, First Family, Catch-22, and Cold Turkey. But it was his first comedy album that made him a star, including bits like
The Driving Instructor.
All right, let's pull out into traffic. Now, what's the first thing we're going to do before we pull out into traffic? What did Mr. Adams do before he let you pull out into traffic? Well, I mean, besides praying, let's say. No, what I had in mind was checking the rearview mirror. You see, we always want to check the rear view. Don't pull out! please don't cry. I'm sorry. But there was this bus, Mrs. Williams.
All those famous routines, the driving instructor, bus driver's school, the retirement party, Abe Lincoln versus yeah. Madison Avenue, many more. People know those by heart.
I know.
That must be extremely flattering.
Well, what was interesting, Joe, a couple of years ago, I was approached by Showtime to do a comedy hour.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to take all those routines and kind of update them. And I did them in front of a live audience, and we did two shows in Pasadena. The audience was largely 35, 40-year-olds, you know, 25 to 40, that age group. And, we told them we were going to be taping the show, and, the people, and we filled up two audiences of about 2,500 apiece, I guess. And they were all 35 and 40 years old, and it worked the same way it did the first time. You know, I mean, the laughs came in exactly the same place and with the same intensity. With there were some exceptions. One was the Khrushchev's landing.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. That really didn't work.
All right, camera one, get in tight on the door. Get in tight on Khrushchev. A what? A mustache? I don't think so, Jer. Jerry, you're on the wrong guy. You're on the wrong. Pan around. Fact sheet I got says he should be a short, stocky guy in a gray suit. Keep. Looks like he slept in it. That's him.
It was dated, but the rest of the material, all the ones you mentioned, they all worked the same way they worked the first time.
Is it possible for you to have a favorite?
Oh, I think the best. It's like picking a favorite child. You know,
mm-hmm.
I love them all for different reasons. I love the driving instructor because I think that was the commercial success that accounted for the popularity.
How fast were you going when Mr. Adams jumped from the car? 75? And where was that? In your driveway.
I like Abe Lincoln because I think it says something, and I think it said something even more today than it did when I first wrote it and performed it.
Hi, Abe, sweetheart. How are you, kid? I'll get it, Bert. Sort of a drag, huh? Well, Abe, you know them small Pennsylvania towns. You seen one, you seen them all.
The telephone was such a part of your act. How did that come to be?
Well, of course, I wasn't the first one to use the telephone. That's been a comedy prop for for some time. I remember reading that one of the first phonograph records ever made was a thing called Cohen on the Telephone. And, of course, George Jessel used to use the telephone to call his mother on his radio show. And Shelley Berman and Mike and Elaine. And it's a device that lent itself to certain routines. Abe Lincoln is really nothing that I'm saying is funny in the Abe Lincoln routine. It's what is unsaid that's funny.
Abe, you got the speech. Abe, you haven't changed the speech, have you? Abe, what do you change the speeches for? A couple minor changes, I'll bet. All right, what are they? You change 87 to 87? I understand it means the same thing, Abe. Well, Abe, that's meant to be a grabber. Abe, we test marketed that in an Erie. And they went out of their minds. Abe, it's sort of like Mark Anthony saying, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, I've got something I want to tell you."
And the audience is kind of—it's kind of a McLuhan kind of thing. It becomes a hot medium instead of a cold medium because the audience is participating. And they're not just sitting back and watching. They're supplying Abe's end of the conversation.
There were two Bob Newhart shows, the first in the 60s being a variety show and a critically acclaimed show.
Oh, okay. The first one, you're right. The first one was a variety show. It was 61 to 62.
Hello, Bob Newhart here. Perry Como. Well, hi, Perry. Well, thank you for calling. Well, it's going just fine so far, Perry. I mean, there isn't, you know, too much can go wrong with a show in the first 10 seconds. Pretty much up to the peacock, you know.
And what happened to that?
It was on a year. We got an Emmy, a Peabody, and a pink slip from NBC all in one year.
Thank you very much. I especially want to thank you. I want to thank the sponsors because they really were great, and NBC because they never interfered in some of the things we did. I wish they had a couple times, but they never did. And to you, you've been sending in very nice letters, and it's meant a lot to me. And although we are going off this year, and it doesn't look like we're going to be on next year, you can't really feel too badly about a year where you've made a couple of friends. So thank you very much, and good night. And let's hear the old theme pop.
It was very draining because I had to come up with a monologue every week, and that was really tough. That was really tough to come up with a quality monologue every week. We were on the bubble with NBC. I think they were somewhat embarrassed because we had received an Emmy, and we also received a George Peabody Award. How can you cancel a show? So they came to me and they said, "Well, we'll pick you up for another year, but you have to get rid of the announcer." And I said, "Well, I can't do that because the announcer is a friend of mine from Chicago, who was largely who was responsible for the first album. He talked the Warner Brother people into recording it, and he was a very hot disc jockey in Chicago, and." They said to me, I put down some routines on a tape, and they listened to it, and they said, okay, we'll record you at your next nightclub. And I said, well, see, there's a problem. I've never played a nightclub. And they said, well, then we'll have to put you in a nightclub. So they got me a booking in a club called the Tidelands in Houston, and that was my first nightclub engagement.
So the first album was your first gig in front of a nightclub audience.
Yeah. I had done maybe what we call club dates, like, you know, appearing for a company in Chicago. But this, that was the very first nightclub appearance.
How much pressure is that?
Well, there was quite a bit of pressure because when I went down there, I only had half an album. and I had to fill up the other side of the album. So I was on the bill. I was the opening act for an act called Ken and Mitzi Welsh. And so after each show, I go back to their room, or they come to my room, and I'd say, here's an idea I had. Is this funny? Is this funny? And they say, yeah, that's funny. Try that tomorrow. And so I had 2 weeks to come up with the material for the other side of the album. So there was the double pressure there.
Mrs. Harrell, we've been over this before, and as you said yourself, you overeat because having a beautiful body, you feel, threatens you. and for some reason, having a fat body doesn't threaten you. Well, I'm happy to hear you've been able to control it. Mrs. Harrell? Yeah, I can't understand you with your mouth full.
Bob Newhart played two of the most successful sitcom characters in television history. He portrayed psychologist Bob Hartley, who we just heard, in The Bob Newhart Show, which ran for 6 seasons beginning in 1972. He also played do-it-yourself book author Dick Loudon, proprietor of a Vermont inn in Newhart. That show ran from 1982 to 1990. Newhart is known to audiences around the world for his work on television, and known to millions more for his Grammy-winning stand-up comedy albums. In the conclusion of our interview with Newhart, he talks about his two successful sitcoms and how he was not nervous to return to television, even though his very first show, a 60s variety program, was abruptly canceled by NBC. That after winning an Emmy and a Peabody Award, Newhart says he was not leery because 10 years had passed and much had changed.
No, at that point I was married, got married in 63. I had three kids at that point. Wanted to get off the road and you know, have a semblance of a normal life. The television show offered me the opportunity to have a kind of normal life instead of being on the road. And the kids would, you know, they travel with me when they could, but as they were getting older, it was becoming harder and harder for them to join me on the road.
The show is, of course, a classic. Why did it work?
I think it worked, and I think it still works because it's about real people and real problems. All the offices I ever worked in, they always knew there was a Carol. There was a neighbor like Bill Daly. I think it dealt, and there was a wife like Emily, and we dealt with real wife problems, you know.
Chicago before dawn. My kind of town.
Maybe a sleeping giant now, but soon it will awaken to become crossroads of America.
Can it, Bob?
You know, Emily, we ought to do this more often.
Why don't we get a paper route?
Real people problems, which is why I think it still works today.
And like Newhart, it was such an ensemble comedy, and you were the calm in the storm. How important was that ensemble?
Well, I told Mary Fran at one point, I said, Mary, we're the glue that holds this together. If we're zanies, then it isn't going to work. You know, if everybody's a zany, it isn't going
to
work.
Emily, you want to explain what led to your fear of flying?
Oh, well, I don't think anybody would be interested in my story. I just thought I'd sit and listen tonight.
I feel you have a lot of hostility toward me.
Why do you say that, Mr. Carlin?
Because Emily, by refusing to tell her story, is implying that her fear is better than mine. I don't like it, I feel threatened by it, and I don't know how to deal with it.
Emily, do you have any hostility to Mr. Carlin?
No, I just didn't think anybody would be interested in my story. I really just thought I'd sit and listen tonight.
You know, I like you for saying that.
Thank you, I like you too, very much.
I don't believe you.
Somehow that has been borne out with the success of Seinfeld, but without the success of any of the cast members. They were an ensemble.
When the Bob Newhart Show went off the air, you returned 4 years later with Newhart. Right. Why were you ready at that point to go back?
I always knew I'd go back. I wanted to leave the show while it was still a success. So I left Newhart in the sixth year, and it still was a success. I always knew I was going to go back on television because I liked the medium. I understood the medium, And I thought it had enormous impact. I did some movies that weren't very successful and did stand-up, continued to do stand-up. I went to my manager and said, who happens to be an executive at MTM, he and Marion Grant founded MTM. And I said, Artie, I said, I think I'd like to go back on television. He said, all right, but don't tell anybody. The typical manager, he said, don't tell anybody. So he went to CBS and went to Bud Grant, who was the head of entertainment for CBS. And he said, I'm not promising anything. He said, but I might be able to talk Bob into coming back on television. And Bud said, where do I sign?
Here comes Big Cloud and he lives in Vermont. He owns a Stratford Inn and he has his own show. And he writes how-to books and he's funny.
How much are your rooms?
How much are the rooms? why don't you step over here and I'll look it up in the ledger.
To be honest with you, we're new at this. We just bought this place. Oh.
rooms. Ah, here we go. That'll be a farthing.
House 40.
Oh, that's a little more than we wanted to spend.
House 20.
Hey, 20's fine.
Okay, if you just give me your John Hancock.
Where?
Right there under John Hancock.
I knew in the back of my mind I was always going to come back to television.
The finale of Newhart was one of the greatest ever. and it was your wife's idea.
It was my wife's idea, yeah. It was actually in the sixth year of Newhart, and I thought CBS was being somewhat unfair to us. They were moving us around, and I saw a lineup recently, and we were at 8:30, then they had us at 9:30, and they had us all over the place. And so we were at a Christmas party here in L.A., and I said to my wife, Jenny, I said, you know, I think this is going to be the last year. I don't think I'm going to go on after this because I don't really like the way CBS is treating us. And she said, well, if it is, she said, you know, you really ought to go off in a dream sequence where you wake up in bed with Emily and you say, honey, you won't believe the dream I just had. And I said, oh, that's a sensational idea. And Susie happened to be at the party, and we told her the idea, and she said, if I'm in Timbuktu, I'll fly back to be back, you know, to be on the show. Anyway, we patched things up with CBS, and I lasted for two more years, and then in the eighth year, I thought that was the time to say, okay, you know, maybe the storylines are getting a little weak, and I went to the writers and gave them the idea, and they fleshed it out. It's interesting because we taped it in front of the audience, and they went crazy. We had a floater, and we just pulled the floater away, and there was a bedroom set, and they didn't even know Susie and I were in bed, and they started to applaud. They started applauding the bedroom set because they recognized it from the Bob Newhart show.
Ah, honey. honey, wake up. You won't believe the dream I just had. What? But don't you want to hear about it?
All right, Bob. What is it?
I was an innkeeper in this crazy little town in Vermont.
We kept trying to cut the show, and we finally said, look, we went to CBS. We got it down to 35 minutes. We can't get it down anymore without really seriously hurting it. So CBS said, okay, all right, we'll let your show run 35 minutes instead of 30. And they notified the stations. Well, some of the stations didn't pick up on it, and so they cut away. Before the scene with Susie and myself.
One of those right here in Albany, New York.
That's what I thought. I was thinking, I knew it was in New York, upstate New York.
I was watching that night.
Go to sleep, Emily. You know, you...
Good evening, I'm Ernie Tatro, live at 9. We'll have the latest...
Oh, my God. And then people were talking about it, and the people in Albany and Albany and other places were saying, what the hell are they talking about? You know? And they had to reran the whole thing.
Yeah, on the news that night.
Well, we broke in with a news break, inadvertently cutting out the very few final seconds of the show. It turns out that tonight's finale was longer than the other programs this season. It was an oversight on our part, and it didn't get entered into the computers. Well, we hope we didn't spoil the ending too much for you. So here's what you missed just after Newhart reveals that his second series has all been a dream.
Yeah.
You followed up with both Bob and George and Leo. Those shows did not last.
Didn't work, no.
Do you ever know what's going to work?
No. No, I don't think you ever know. Television, as a lot of people have found out, it isn't a just showing up medium. It isn't, okay, I'm here. You got to prove yourself each time, and you got to find that chemistry that's so hard to find. I mean, Seinfeld had it, and Friends has it. Among the comedy shows, Everyone Loves Raymond. They have that chemistry, but it's very difficult to find. And I loved George and Leo. I love working with Judd. He was he's a doll to work with, and mm-hmm. of course he was very strong, which is always you always look for somebody strong to play opposite. But the interior chemistry we never ever kind of settled at.
Actually, we had Judd Hirsch on this program one time, and he said once you dress up as a lobster, the show is probably in trouble.
I said that to him on the set when we were filming that. I said, usually you don't see a lobster suit until maybe the fifth or sixth year. You don't see it five or six shows in.
Would you ever see yourself returning to series television?
Well, assuming that my manager is not going to see this or hear it, probably not. No. He said never say no. Well, I said okay, but I think it's a different time. I'm not up to the pressure. I don't want to put myself in that position again of grabbing the ratings every Wednesday and seeing where you are and whether you're up one or down one. Things have been very. I look back on my career and I'm very happy and satisfied with it. And now it's someone else's turn.
Bob Newhart, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. It's a great thrill for me to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Joe.
Thanks so much.
I enjoyed it.
It was a great thrill in 2006 to sit down with Bob Newhart. We have been listening to my 2006 interview with Newhart, who died in Los Angeles at the age of 94. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Meow.